أعوذ بالله من الشيطان الرجيم. بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم. الحمد لله رب العالمين، بارئ الخلائق أجمعين، والصلاة والسلام على أشرف الأنبياء والمرسلين، سيدنا ونبينا وحبيب قلوبنا وطبيب نفوسنا وشفيع ذنوبنا أبي القاسم محمد.
اللهم
ثم الصلاة والسلام على آل بيته الطيبين الطاهرين المظلومين، واللعنة الله على أعدائهم أجمعين من يوم عداوتهم إلى يوم الدين. أما بعد، فقد قال الله تبارك وتعالى في كتاب وهو أصدق القائلين، بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم: واعتصموا بحبل الله جميعا ولا تفرقوا واذكروا نعمة الله عليكم إذ كنتم أعداء فألف بين قلوبكم فأصبحتم بنعمته إخوانا وكنتم على شفا حفرة من النار فأنقذكم منها كذلك يبين الله لكم آياته لعلكم تهتدون. صلوات الله. Last night we began discussing the early period of Muslim leadership and Khilafa, and tonight I was to discuss a different subject altogether as a continuation, but I left some last night, so I just want to wrap that up very quickly. Just a few points of clarification though. Last night I did mention that the legacy of discrimination and that sense where Muslims confused the idea of the Prophet ﷺ being an Arab versus Islam as a universal faith that Allah established from the time of Adam has lingered on to this day, where a lot of nations where the majority are Muslims, there tends to be this distinction between an Arab and a non-Arab. And I mentioned in passing that to this day you will find that in many Arab nations, non-Arabs feel discriminated against and treated as lesser, even if they share the same faith. Now, this is not based on any feedback from anyone, but just my own thoughts. I thought I should clarify that when I say that, I do not mean every individual Arab discriminates against non-Arabs. What I meant is, as a government, as a policy, the rules and the policy promote pan-Arabism versus pan-Islamicism. And therefore, for example, you will find that in nations such as this that are predominantly non-Muslim, if you live here for 3, 4, 5 years and pay taxes and work hard and contribute, the country acknowledges and allows you citizenship. But in many of these Arab nations, you could move there and live all your life, 10, 20, 30, 40, 50 years, but you will still not be allowed to live there and become part of that citizenship and nationality. There may be whatever reason there are, but if we claim to be Muslims and role models, then our inspiration and our leadership must inspire that. But if we don't find examples of those in our history, and we find the converse where, you know, leadership indicated that Arabs are superior to non-Arabs, then that legacy remains in our ethos. I've also received a number of questions asking to clarify certain things, such as, for example, the Shias are often told that it was the Shia who invited Imam al-Hussein and then killed him. So how do we respond to that? Or the issue of the fast of Ashura and so on. Now, if I begin responding to this, then obviously it will take time from the discussion. So I will leave this, and inshallah, on the very last lecture when we do a conclusion, if there is time as part of tying loose ends, we will cover anything like this. Last night I said that just as major points and highlights from the observance of the Shia, as well as academics and historians who are not even Muslims in some cases, they have critiqued the early caliphate, and I identified three issues of concern that were raised in the first caliphate and the second caliphate. Now, with regards to the third caliphate, I will not discuss in detail because, as I said, I was to do this last night, and I just want to wrap it up very quickly. What historians have observed with regards to the Khilafah of Uthman bin Affan is that, as I mentioned last night, that it appears that if Abu Ubaidah had not predeceased Umar, then he was to be the third caliph. So there was now a need for a third candidate. And the Caliph Umar decided, instead of appointing one individual just like he was appointed by Abu Bakr, he would set up a shura. Some of the historians say this was in part because the Caliph Umar was trying to Islamicize that Qurayshi Khilafat that had come into place when his predecessor Abu Bakr had brought the Quraysh after Fath Makkah and given them positions of command. And so what the Caliph Umar was trying to do was to say, the Quraysh are now here to stay. They have taken positions of authority. But let us Islamicize this government further by introducing some Quranic principles, such as, for example, the Quran tells the Prophet that consult your companions. And so this idea of shura should be introduced, where Muslims do things through consultation. The other thing he was trying to introduce was this idea of sabiqa, that those who became Muslims earlier should be given some preference over those who became Muslims after. Now, he therefore decided he would set up a shura and put six people in this consultative council, and from this six, one of them should be the caliph. And these six individuals that he chose was Uthman bin Affan, Zubair bin al-Awam, Talha, Abdul Rahman bin Auf, Sa'ad bin Abi Waqqas, the father of Umar Asad, and Ali bin Abi Talib. Now, he then put some rules around how this would work. He said, if the group divides in opinion into two groups, three and three, then my son Abdullah bin Umar will decide from which group the caliph should be chosen. And preference should be given to the group in which Abdul Rahman bin Auf is present. And if all agree on one caliph and two disagree, then they must accept that caliph, otherwise they should be beheaded. Now, historians, as well as Imam Ali alayhi salam, he comments on this and complains to Abdullah ibn Abbas as to why it was unfair right from the start in how it was set up. The reason it was unfair is as follows. Abdul Rahman bin Auf was Uthman's brother-in-law. He was married to Uthman's sister. And his vote was given extra weight. Sa'ad bin Abi Waqqas was related to Abdul Rahman bin Auf. Talha belonged to the tribe of Taim, which was the same tribe that Abu Bakr belonged to, and therefore he was opposed to Ali. Abdullah bin Umar, who would have a say if there was an equal division, did not even pledge allegiance to Ali after, so he was opposed to Ali. So really, in all these six, the only person who sided with Ali was Zubair. And Zubair removed his vote and said, I withdraw my name in favor of Ali at the time. Zubair was very loyal to Ali, even though he fought against him in the Battle of Jamal. And he was related to Imam Ali, because Zubair's mother and Imam Ali's father were siblings. Zubair's mother was the sister of Abdullah, the Prophet's father, and Abu Talib and Hamza. She was the daughter of Abdul Muttalib. So they were cousins, actually, Imam Ali and Zubair. But Zubair's wife was the sister of Aisha. And Zubair had a son called Abdullah, who was very close to his aunt. And he was severely against Ali bin Abi Talib. And he drove his father against Ali. And that is why we have in Nahjul Balagha that Imam Ali has a saying. He says, Zubair continued to be a member of our family until his wretched son Abdullah came forward. So the whole shura was set up in such a manner that there was no chance that Ali bin Abi Talib could have won. This is the opinion not of the Shia, but of Imam Ali himself. And you will find his arguments in Nahjul Balagha. And Ibn Abi al-Hadid al-Mu'tazili has explained this in detail in his sharh of Nahjul Balagha. What the historians say is that, first of all, Uthman, by his nature, was averse to bloodshed. He did not really show a lot of interest in military fight, and he often was excused by the Prophet himself from war. And this was an important quality for any leader to have. And Wilford Medlung, that I mentioned yesterday, says that at no time did he display any qualities of public leadership. In fact, out of these six candidates, he was the only one whom neither the Prophet nor the first two caliphs ever positioned as a leader or commander of any army or any expedition. So the advantage of Uthman, from the historian perspective at least, is that he was an Umayyad, and therefore he would have had the support of the Quraysh in continuing the Khilafat and leadership. And as I mentioned last night, Imam Ali was adamant that if he would take Khilafat, he would not follow the seerah of the Shaykhain. He would only follow Quran and seerah of the Prophet. Now, at a high level, the three issues that we were going to talk about with regards to the Khilafat of Uthman was, one, nepotism, the idea of family members being given positions of authority. The second was misappropriation of wealth, large sums of public treasury being given to family members. And the third was mistreatment of some of the Sahabas, in particular Abu Dharr al-Ghifari. Now, I have read versions of the story of Abu Dharr al-Ghifari and Uthman and Muawiyah from a Sunni perspective. And in my humble opinion, again, it is somewhat revisionist of history in suggesting that there was no discord, and, you know, the Caliph Uthman requested the Sahaba Abu Dharr to, you know, move to Damascus, and Muawiyah asked him to come back, and then that sort of a thing. But when you read all the reports of history, it was a harsh treatment. He was exiled, he was sent to Rabza, where he did not want to go, and he died in isolation. So there is enough historic evidence to suggest that him, as well as other companions, Abdullah ibn Mas'ud and others are mentioned as well, who were mistreated. With regards to nepotism, there is a lot of names and incidents to show family members that were given positions of authority, governorship, and so on, and we cannot get into all of this. But if you take a book like the one I mentioned by Medlung, Succession to Muhammad, you will find full references, names, and all the details. Misappropriation of wealth as well, there is lots of names, and the figures we're seeing is all companions of the Prophet who had very little at the time of the Prophet. When they die or pass away after the time of Uthman, they're leaving sums of wealth like 100,000 dinars, 150,000 dinars, thousands of camels and slaves and villages and farmlands, and, you know. And I can't, unfortunately, go into all this, but what I tried to do was try to say, we hear numbers like 100,000 dinars, 10,000 dirhams, what does this mean really? So, and I may be wrong here, but this is the approach I took. I tried to find out what is a dinar and a dirham. A dinar is 4.2 grams of pure gold. A dirham is about 2.98 grams of pure silver, or 3 grams of silver. If you take the current price of gold at about $40 to $50 a gram, 4.25 grams is about $200 for a dinar. So if a Sahaba dies leaving 100,000 dinars, in today's estimate, that means from, you know, very basic, humble, poor life before the Prophet, by the time the Caliph Uthman comes to power, he's dying leaving $20 million, $37 million. We're talking of millions of dollars. And this is besides the 10,000 sheep and 1,000 camels and 100 horses and, you know, leaving for the wives 80,000 dinars as inheritance and so on and so forth. So something was going wrong with the Ummah. And when we question the adala of the Sahaba, it is not, again, because the Shias like to curse the Sahaba. It is because, as Muslims, we cannot move forward unless we acknowledge we have a problem and we begin to talk about this. We can talk about it respectfully, but we nonetheless have to talk about it because these are historic facts. We cannot create sanctities around individuals and say we cannot talk about it. I give you a very simple example and then I end this discussion. We talk about the wife of the Prophet Aisha, for example. There is a very popular, well-known Sunni scholar called Dr. Yusuf Qardawi, who was from Al-Azhar in Egypt, and he's now based in Qatar. And he has a lengthy article on the internet where he talks about this hadith al-ifk. Many of you may know about this scandal of ifk that was imputed on the wife of the Prophet Aisha. In summary, the Prophet ﷺ was once traveling and he had taken his wife Aisha with him. And when the camp moved back to Medina, she got left behind. And a young, handsome man from the Muslims happened to be there as well. And he came across her and he brought her back to Medina. Now, she was young, he was young, and some of the hypocrites began spreading scandals and rumors about her and the young man, which caused her a lot of anguish. And there is a whole story to it as to how her name was cleared and that this was false allegations and so on. And it's called Hadith al-Ifk. Now, Dr. Yusuf Qardawi, when he discusses this, he talks about what happened and why she got left behind. And he praises her at every moment and occasion, such as, for example, how modest she was, that when she needed some privacy, whereas others would use, you know, a nearby place as a washroom, she would go far away. And he talks about how she lost a necklace. And then he goes into details of how non-materialistic she was, that the necklace she had was made from this gemstone called onyx. Onyx is like a black stone and material that has very little. It's not so precious. But he says she was so modest and so non-materialistic that, you know, this was the kind of necklace she wore despite being the wife of the Prophet, when she could have been wearing the most expensive necklaces that any Arab wanted to wear, being the wife of the Prophet. Now, my question to Dr. Yusuf Qardawi is this, that historic reports show that Muawiyah, for example, sent Aisha a necklace that was worth 100,000 dirhams, and she accepted it. If you go by the conversion rates that I'm talking about, that's a necklace that's worth $165,000 today, right? So, what changed? We're not here to curse, we're not here to, you know, abuse, we're not here to use vulgar language, but we have to read history with honesty. And this is only to share the Shia perspective. And there are many such incidents. There was a man called Murra who went to a man called Ziyad bin Abi. Ziyad was a man who was wretched. His son is Ubaidullah ibn Ziyad, who took the governorship in Kufa. Ziyad was a man whose father nobody knew he was. So they used to call him Ziyad bin Abihi, Ziyad the son of his father. Right? And there were two or three men in Arabia that were suspected to have been his father. And he wanted people to say that his father was Abu Sufyan. So Abu Sufyan was one of the possible candidates of the three men who may have fathered him. But he was of illegitimate birth. So nobody acknowledged who his father was. And that bothered him, despite having position and governorship and so on. And Ziyad bin Abi became Muawiyah's governor in Basra. And a man called Murra went to Basra asking Ziyad for some favors, and Ziyad refused. So Murra goes to the wife of the Prophet Aisha bint Abi Bakr and asks her to help him out. She writes a letter to Ziyad and says, "From Ummul Mu'mineen Aisha to Ziyad bin Abi Sufyan." And he was so delighted that Ummul Mu'mineen has now acknowledged me, that I am not of illegitimate birth and I am the son of Abu Sufyan. He gave Murra 100 acres of land. And he built a special river that came straight into his farmland to irrigate his land. And that river came to be known as Nahr Murra, the river of Murra. So there's a lot of such incidents that Madelung and others look at and discuss and say that there was a lot of power at play. And there were some instances where governors of Muawiyah were sending money and favors to Aisha as the wife of the Prophet, using it to leverage, you know, her influence over the Ummah and so on and so forth. So, as Shias, we look at things as honestly as possible as we can. And as I said, the Shia argument and weight and strength is that we're not looking at Shia sources here. We're looking at sources that all Muslims use. And it's not to disparage, but to say we have to honestly look and not assume that everybody who was of a particular, you know, integrity before the Prophet was the same after the Prophet ﷺ passed away. Ziyad bin Thabit, for example, when he passed away, he left so much gold and silver that hammers had to be used to break the gold and silver just to distribute it to his heirs. How did these people get all this money, and where did this come from? These need to be looked at. The Battle of Jamal was fought by Talha, Zubair and Aisha against Imam Ali. You cannot just go to battle and take tens of thousands of people. You need to feed the army, you need to equip the army, you need horses, you need weapons, you need... Who was funding all this? These are the kind of things that you look at honestly as a historian, right? You look at it today as well, when people look at ISIS and they say, you know, this cannot be just a bunch of ragtag individuals who just stood up and said, we're going to go fight and take over Syria and Iraq. Look at the kind of vehicles and trucks they're driving. They're driving brand new trucks that are worth hundreds of thousands of dollars. Look at the kind of equipment mounted on these trucks. Somebody must be paying for this. Where is the funding coming from, right? This is the argument that constantly comes about. So it's one thing to believe in something just from faith. It's another thing to look at it with open eyes and then study history and find out where Muslims had pitfalls and where they went wrong. Now, in terms of the policies of Imam Ali when he took over Khilafat and how he tried to reverse these things, you will see that, for example, first of all, he refused to follow the seerah of the Shaykhain. Secondly, Imam Ali gave a lot of preference to the non-Arabs. The Persians absolutely loved him, right? You will see, for example, a large number of followers of Mukhtar in taking the revenge of Imam Hussein were Persians. And the reason the Persians followed him and became Alawi is because of their love for Ali bin Abi Talib, because they saw him as being very fair in saying, I will appoint people and treat people on the basis of taqwa, not on the basis of their ethnicity. So if you look at Nahjul Balagha as well, I talked about, for example, the collection of zakat and the policy of the first caliph where he went to war to collect zakat and this hurub ridda. You read Nahjul Balagha and see Imam Ali's letter to his tax collectors. You will see a complete opposite. He gives very clear instructions to his tax collectors and says, when you go out and collect taxes, don't come in showing yourself as being superior to them. Don't intimidate the Muslims that you're collecting zakat from. If they tell you they don't have any zakat to give, leave them alone. Don't insist and say you have zakat and you have to give. If they say they have zakat to give and there are animals in a pen and they're going to give you an animal from what they have, don't go into that place where the animals are. You stay out and let them bring the animal to you. If they bring the animal to you, don't say, no, this animal is defective, I'm going to take that animal. He asks them to be completely accommodating and sympathetic and empathizing and respecting the integrity of the Muslims. Right? So you see these sort of reversals. There is another khutbah in Nahjul Balagha where he talks about what happened at the time of Uthman. And he says, I swear by Allah, even if I find women that were married and their mahar was given with unlawful money from Baytul Mal, I will take that money back and have them divorced. But I will not tolerate money being misappropriated from the wealth of Muslims. Now, these sort of comments from Imam Ali suggests that he saw problems and that he was trying to rectify these. But obviously, he was occupied with battles for the 3.5 years that he ruled, one after the other, and not everything was put into place. So this is in summary of, you know, what we were trying to discuss with the early Khilafat. If you can recite a salawat ala Muhammad wa ala. Now, we fast forward to a much later period, closer to our times. And we say that the Umayyads and Abbasids, of course, did not rule according to any Islamic principle as such. The Umayyads ruled based on a model of government that was Byzantium, and then the Abbasids ruled on what was a Sassanid form of ruling and government. But they used Islam to justify their dominance over Muslims, and they showed some un-Islamic behavior, such as, for example, they would institute the punishment or hudud of Islam on the laity and common people, but they themselves were above the law, which you see even today in societies that will punish the lay common people with Islamic punishment, chop their hands off and so on, but their own royal family will commit the most horrendous crimes when they travel overseas, and they are covered and nobody talks about that. The other thing that the Umayyads Abbasids did was, the Prophet ﷺ was spreading Islam through ambassadors. He would send ambassadors to different countries and invite them to Islam. But what they would do is they would send armies and invade those lands, taking a cue perhaps from predecessors who invaded, for example, Egypt and Syria and so on. And part of this was not to spread Islam, but it was to colonize so that they could take the natural resources from those lands and they could collect tax and jizya from those places, which is really what the colonialists did as well. When the Banu Abbas came to fall in 1258, the Khilafat ended and that was replaced by a sultanate. And this sultanate was largely the Ottoman Empire. The Ottoman Empire that came after Banu Abbas were the Turks, which would be modern day today Turkey. And by that time now, the Muslim Empire was not held by one dynasty only. There was on one side the Ottoman Empire. There were in Persia, there were the Safavi that were Shia. Then in India, you had the Mughal Empire. You had the Fatimids and so on and so forth. So the Muslim Empire was breaking up and it wasn't really one. But for the most part, the large majority that defined themselves as Sunni, they were looking up to this Ottoman Empire that were the Turks. And even though there was this idea that we are under the rule of a Khilafah, that old system of the Khalifa being the representative of the Prophet ﷺ was now fading away and it was becoming more secular in a sense, but Islam continued to be the more vital social and political force. Now, during the 18th century, the Sultanate began having two issues. One, there was a stagnation and a degeneration in the Muslim Khilafat or Caliphate in the Ottoman Empire. The other thing was that Western civilization was now growing. So now there were revivalist movements and Muslims were now concerned that we need to respond to Western civilization and Muslims need to come out of all the stagnation that they are in. And this began all the different types of reforms and revivals with good intention or bad intention. You had, for example, the Wahhabi movement that was led by Muhammad bin Abdul Wahhab, inspired by Ibn Taymiyyah. You had, for example, in Africa, you had the Grand Sanusi of Libya, you had the Mahdi of Sudan. In India, in the Indian subcontinent, you had Sheikh Ahmad Sirhindi, and you had Shah Waliullah Dehlawi, and so on. And these were all trying to reform Islam. Now, by the time you came to the late 19th century, early 20th century, there was an uprising in the Arab world that was called An-Nahda. An-Nahda means the awakening or the renaissance or the rebirth. And I like to think of it as the first Arab Spring. Okay, and it began in Egypt and then it quickly moved to the other areas that the Ottoman Empire ruled over, including Lebanon, Syria and other places. Now, what was the cause of this Nahda and this uprising? There were several. One was to rise against Western powers because they were seeing colonialism coming into play. Like, for example, Napoleon invaded Egypt in 1798. So Muslims started getting concerned with this idea of Western powers coming into Muslim lands. The other was that this realization that Muslim societies are now stagnating. And the third was there was a lot of discontentment within the Ottoman Empire, and the Ottoman Empire was trying to reform itself. And so it began a widespread reform that were called Tanzimat. And we can't get into all those details, but if you Google Tanzimat, Ottoman Empire, you'll find a whole Wikipedia article on this. And so they made a lot of reforms in terms of society, education, social structure, and so on. But what they did not change is the leadership. The leadership continued to be kings and monarchs at first, and then these kings and monarchs were now replaced by quote-unquote elected leaders who are still corrupt and oppressive. Now, in 1914, after the First World War, the Ottoman Empire was now being broken up by the British. In India, the Muslims were very concerned about this and they sent a delegation to England asking the British to keep the Khalifa in place and somebody to represent the Muslim. And this was called the Khilafat movement. And it lasted from 1919 to 1924. The British refused this and they did not accept this request from the Muslims of India. By 1922, the Turkish nationalists themselves disbanded the Ottoman Empire. And the Muslim Khilafat officially came to an end in 1924. If I'm not mistaken, it was the 3rd of March, 1924. Now, let's talk a little bit about what happened then. As soon as these problems happened, Muslims at first began thinking this was a punishment from Allah, and there must be a reason why our Khilafat that has lasted since the time of the Prophet has broken up. Immediately Muslims broke into two groups. There was one group that we will refer to as the modernists, who tried to reform Islam. There was another group that we will refer to as fundamentalists, because that's what historians refer to them. We might not agree with the term, but this is what it was. Now let's talk about the modernists first, and I'll talk about it in two ways. There are many examples we can give, but I'll give an example from the Indian subcontinent and from the Middle East. In the Indian subcontinent, because the British were already there as colonialists, the Muslims could already sense the idea of non-Muslims dominating over Muslims and a declining Muslim society. And two figures became very popular as reformists and with modern ideas. One was an individual who was called Sayyid Ahmad Khan, who came to be known as Sir Sayyid. The other was an individual called Muhammad Iqbal, that many of us refer to as Allama Iqbal. Now, Ahmad Khan was in favor of modernity over tradition. He was influenced by 19th century European rationalism, and he actually did not believe in a lot of things that Muslims traditionally believed. So, for example, the belief in angels. He didn't believe angels were really beings. He liked to interpret them metaphorically, or, for example, any idea of miracles and how the universe was created. Rather than religious texts, he deferred and preferred a more scientific understanding of these things. And tomorrow night we shall talk about how in society science became God. Now, he traveled to England to see for himself how the Europeans have progressed. And because of his ideas and contributions, Queen Victoria of England knighted him, because of which he came to be called Sir Sayyid Ahmad Khan. And when he came back, he established Aligarh University, and he based it on the model of Cambridge University. Muhammad Iqbal was also educated in Cambridge and Munich in philosophy and law. And he again had very modern ideas. He, for example, believed that ijtihad should not be closed and should be open, but ijtihad should not only be for ulama. Qualified individuals should also be allowed to do ijtihad. And that the right of ijtihad should move from a traditional institution to a national assembly that would represent the ijma' of the community. So you can see his ideas were trying to create the idea of democracy that he had witnessed living in the West. There was also an individual called Ubaidullah Sindhi, who was actually born a Sikh, and then he converted to Islam. And he lived in Russia and Turkey, and then he came back and tried to reform Islam. So there were such individuals within the Indian subcontinent who went out to Europe looking for why they are progressive and Muslims are not. And then when they came back to try and reform Muslims, they tried to reform Muslims using the Western civilization as the model of how Muslims can better themselves and come out of stagnation. Now, their ideas, people like Sir Sayyid and Iqbal, they became national symbols, particularly when within India Muslims broke away and created Pakistan. So they became national symbols for Pakistan, and they were very effective in producing new ideas and attractive ideas, but in terms of practice, their philosophy did not gain any traction. And for the most part, they did not really achieve considerable success. And we shall say why very shortly. But very quickly now, let's look at the idea of modernism in the Middle East. In the Middle East, there was a man called Jamaluddin Afghani. And Sayyid Jamaluddin Afghani is said to have been an Iranian of origin. And there is a lot of obscurity as to what his origin is. He quite likely was a Shia. But he took the name Al-Afghani. He was fluent in multiple languages. He spoke Arabic like an Arab. And he lived in multiple countries. But he was a reformist. And so he mingled with Muslims of all ethnicities, all madhabs, and tried to create reform in Islam. And his attempt was to try and bridge a gap between Islam and modern science. He also traveled to Europe to try and understand what was the cause of the success of the Europeans and the non-Muslims, and why Muslims has failed. When he came back from Europe, he set up an objective with three goals. His first goal was that Muslims need to liberate themselves from colonial rule. Secondly, there has to be a solidarity amongst Muslims that opposes nation states. And thirdly, we should promote pan-Islamism, the idea that there is one Islam and one community around the world. Now, he went to Egypt. In Egypt, he met a man called Muhammad Abdu. Muhammad Abdu was a very learned scholar at Al-Azhar University and was at one point the Grand Mufti of Egypt. But this Grand Mufti of Egypt was a student of Jamaluddin Afghani. He was very much impressed with this idea of reform, and he had these modern ideas just like Allama Iqbal. And he tried to make a lot of changes to Islamic law so that it would be very flexible and it could respond and change with the times. He had a student called Rashid Rida, Muhammad Rashid Rida. Muhammad Rashid Rida studied under Abdu, and he encouraged his teacher to write a tafsir of Quran that explains Islam and Quran from a modern and a scientific perspective, a rationalist tafsir of Quran. And Muhammad Abdu therefore began delivering lectures on Quran and tafsir, and Rashid Rida would take very detailed notes and compile this into tafsir. The tafsir did not complete before Abdu died, but Rashid Rida completed it, and it came to be known as Tafsir al-Manar. Now, Tafsir al-Manar is a good work, very popular work, but it has the same issues, where it takes everything in the Quran, such as miracles, and questions them, and tries to give it a scientific explanation. So if the Quran says that a prophet of God brought the dead back to life, he would explain it as the dead back to life was not physical, but a spiritual revival of the heart. If Ibrahim cut the heads of four birds and mixed it up and the birds came and the heads joined, he would explain it as Ibrahim didn't actually slaughter the birds, he trained the birds, and then when he called them, the birds came to him. So he reinterpreted everything. And a large part of Allama Tabatabai's Tafsir al-Mizan is essentially a criticism of Abdu's Tafsir al-Manar. But that is not of our concern here. Now, the Islamic modernists were for the most part, as you have observed, Western educated. Like Allama Iqbal, to Sir Sayyid, to Jamaluddin Afghani, they all lived in the West. The reason why they could not make considerable changes in the Muslim community is because Muslims look at Islam as something sacred and something that should not be changing, something immutable. The laws of God should be perfect, they should not be something that constantly needs revision. Human laws will constantly need to change and are not perfect. Furthermore, the fact that these modernists had studied in the West, the Muslims were very suspicious of them. And the approach they took is to criticize the traditional ulama. And this will tie into some of what we discuss tomorrow night. A lot of these reformers blamed the ulama and said, look, these ulamas are living in madrasas, in small villages, in faraway lands. They have no idea the struggles we have living in these lands. And you have to be living here to understand the challenge. And because they don't understand the challenge, they don't feel the need to reform Islam. And that is why they were trying to be the reformers of Islam. But Muslims, for the most part, would have nothing of it because the source did not seem to be a source that is authoritative enough. Now, very quickly now, Islamic fundamentalism. When colonialism began to spread and the Khilafat collapsed, the other side of Muslims, so Muslims broke into two groups. There was one that said, we now have to reform Islam. Let's go and see what Europe is doing. Let's come back and let's implement the Western model and reform Islam. Some of them took the other extreme and said, we don't need to reform Islam, we need to revive Islam. And the problem is, we have neglected Quran and we have neglected Hadith. And Muslims, the problem is they've become materialistic and there is moral decadence. And we now need to revive and bring the spirit of Islam back. Surprisingly, the first person and one of the pioneers of this was Muhammad Rashid Rida, the student of Abdu, who was the student of Jamaluddin Afghani. So what happened was when Abdu died, Rashid Rida took over the role of Abdu as a leading figure in that movement of Islamic theology revival and reform. And in the last 20 years of his life, he changed from being a reformer and a modernist to being more fundamentalist and arguing for opposition to the West. And so he witnessed a lot of things regarding the European powers that really bothered him. And he is known to have said that the only language the West understands is power and violence, which they inflict on their subjects whom they colonize. And so he used Quran tafsir and sources in hadith to justify his theology of resistance, and he distanced himself from his mentors, from Abdu and Jamaluddin Afghani. He argued that what we need is an all-out war against the enemy. He opposed the Sufis because they believed in detachment from the world and were not participating in society. And he began calling himself a Salafi, taking the word that a Salafi is someone who follows the earliest companions of the Prophet, and in a sense calling for a puritanical Islam, to say the only way we will find pure Islam is to go right back to the earliest days of the Prophet. That would be the purest Islam that we can find. Now, he had a student called Hassan al-Banna. Hassan al-Banna took over from Rashid Rida, and he argued the same points, and he formed to make some practical steps towards reviving Islam and taking Muslims back to original Islam. He formed an organization in Egypt called Ikhwanul Muslimin, Islamic Brotherhood, which was the most powerful and popular political party of Muslims in the 20th century. In India, you had something similar, where you had an individual called Maulana Abul A'la Maududi, and later in Pakistan, who formed the Jamaat-e-Islami, or Islamic Society. Maududi was drawn into politics for a different reason. Maududi came into politics because he witnessed the Hindu-Muslim conflict when Pakistan was separating from India. And that bothered him a lot. And his first book was Al-Jihad fil Islam, where he tried to explain the concept of jihad in Islam. His central argument was that we live in a period of Jahiliyyah, and that is identified as Western culture. And this Western culture must be eradicated in all its forms if Islam is to be revived. And the first issue that the Muslim fundamentalists ignored was that scientific and technological progress is not the result of any specific dogma or religion or faith. It is merely human progress. And therefore, not everything that is Western has to necessarily be anti-Islam. The second thing that these revivalists or fundamentalists, as they are being referred to, the second mistake they made was that most Muslims were now being born and raised in these non-Muslim societies. Gone were the days when Muslims were only born and raised in Muslim societies, where you could speak of us Muslims versus the West. A lot of Muslims were being born in non-Muslim societies and growing up in those cultures. So the lines of us versus them were not so black and white. Yet another issue was that there were many systems now in place that were becoming global and were not isolated. So keeping away from them simply meant loss for Muslims. As an example, the banking system. As an example, the political system, where you had things like democracy. As an example, university education, both for males and females. These things were happening globally in the non-Muslim world. Muslims had two choices. One is to find a response to this that was Islamic, to say, we will have banking as well, but we will have an Islamic version. We will have democracy as well, but it will be led by Islamic authorities. We will have university education for men and women, but it will be within an Islamic framework. Instead, the argument was that no, anything from the West was bad, and we need to shun it and take back to the life and the times when the Prophet ﷺ lived. And this set Muslims back quite a bit, and it would take decades for them to catch up. Now, this was not the first time it was happening. It had happened during the Ottoman Empire's time. During the time of the Ottomans and other times, Islam, we are told, was at one point the leaders of civilization, and all the scientists and minds and brains came from the Muslims. How did it happen that Muslims declined? One of the reasons for the decline of Muslims is that people from non-Muslim societies, from Europe, when they interacted with the Arabs, they learned Arabic and they translated the works of the Muslims from Arabic to Latin. Even the works that Muslims had translated from Greek to Arabic, they translated it from Arabic to Latin. Muslims, however, were told that it is kufr to learn the language of the kuffar and mushrikeen. You should only learn Arabic. So now, whatever improvements in science that the non-Muslims were making, those were not coming to the Muslims, because Muslims were not learning Latin to translate it back to Arabic for the majority, or for whatever languages in the lands of the Muslims, whether it was Turkish or Urdu or Farsi, it was not coming back. Another example, Muslims, when the printing press was introduced, because back in the time writing took a lot of time, and if you wanted to make a copy of a book, you had to go to a place where you'd go to a scribe and pay him money and he would copy the book for you. Now, when the printing press was invented, these scribes were afraid that they're going to go out of business because nobody's going to go to them. So they instigated partly this, but they came up with this idea that the Arabic script is sacred. And in those days when you printed, the printing press was, you'd set up those letters and models, right? And you'd be stamping, there'd be stamp printing. So they said, look, when you're stamping, you are hitting. How can you slap on the Quran? You cannot print the Quran because that is disrespect to the Quran. So Quran has to be handwritten only. The Christians, though, were very quickly printing the Bible, translating it to Arabic and spreading it, right? The Muslims were saying it's haram to use a print. So what they did was, they allowed printing presses in their lands, and they did not allow Muslims to use those printing presses, but they allowed non-Muslims to do so. And even when they later came to the idea that now we will print the Quran, they said we will hire non-Muslims to print the Quran, but a Muslim should not disrespect the Quran. You know, this was the kind of mindset and leadership that Muslims had. Now, fundamentalists essentially limited themselves to the time of the Prophet ﷺ. What happened was, they failed to see that Islam did not start with the Prophet in Arabia. Islam started from the time of Adam. Islam was the religion of God, a universal faith for all humanity through all times. And therefore, they did not distinguish Arab culture and the time of the Prophet from Islam itself as the actual teaching of the Quran. If they would have seen things other ways, then what they would have concluded is that if we expose ourselves to the culture of other communities, not only will it change our perspective, but they will realize the beauty of Islam. And the real beauty of Islam lies in the fact that you're able to infuse it into all cultures and societies with the same core principles. So the Afghani or the Malaysian or the Chinese or the Russian or the American does not have to dress like an Arab, does not have to eat Arabic food, does not have to behave in a particular manner to be a Muslim. They can keep their own culture, they can keep their own language, but you can still introduce the fundamental principles of Islam, principles such as monotheism and belief in one God, principles such as social and economic justice, principles such as pious leadership, that our leaders should have taqwa, and so on and so forth. Now, I mentioned Hassan al-Banna, who set up this Ikhwan al-Muslimin. Hassan al-Banna also read Muhammad Abdu at first, because his father was a student of Abdu. Not only was he a student of Rashid Rida, but his father was a student of Abdu. Banna was convinced of the argument of Rida, but he had other reasons that also caused him to take this fundamentalist approach. One was, he saw that Muslims were morally depraved now and falling back because they were imitating the Westerners in their lifestyle. The other thing was that he saw certain things like the destruction of Palestine. And he was dismayed with this idea that there was a lot of hypocrisy in the West, where on one hand the United States spoke of human rights, on the other hand they treated the Palestinians in this manner. And these sort of galvanized and, you know, cemented his idea that the West is the enemy. Banna was assassinated in 1949. When he was assassinated, his position was taken over by another individual who is the person I really want to talk about before I conclude tonight. And this was somebody called Sayyid Qutb. Sayyid Qutb is regarded by Western scholars to be the father of modern terrorism. But is he the father of modern terrorism? perhaps in the opinion of some, he is an inspiration to many others who do not subscribe to terrorism. Sayyid Qutb was born in 1906 and he was hanged by the Egyptian government in 1966. He was the most significant member. Now, it's a very interesting journey Sayyid Qutb had. Sayyid Qutb was originally a very modern man. He used to write novels, fiction novels. He studied literature. And then he worked for the Ministry of Education in Egypt, and they sent him to the United States for 2 years to study the education system in the American society and bring ideas back that could be implemented in the Egyptian education system. In the 2 years that he lived there, he witnessed American society, but his experience was very different from those of the reformers like Sir Sayyid and Jamaluddin Afghani and Allama Iqbal. His was completely the opposite. He was shocked to see how people lived in the West, and he thought they were the most depraved of all people, absolutely immoral. So he came back and wrote a paper on what the America that I saw, or the America I have seen. And in it he describes all the things he saw in America, and he describes, for example, the American woman in graphic detail of how shameless she is and how she dresses almost naked. And he uses this statement and says, I saw in the West men and women, they mix with each other like animals. These are his terms. He says, whether you go watch a boxing match or you go to the church, they mix with each other like animals. This was his opinion, of course. Now, when he came back to Egypt, he joined Ikhwan al-Muslimin and he took over from Banna. And he was in constant, strife with the Egyptian government that was more secular. So he was in and out of prison all the time. He was put in prison for 10 years, and in prison he wrote a tafsir that was called Fi Dhilal al-Qur'an, in the shade of the Qur'an. And this is very popular now amongst the Salafis as well. They use this tafsir quite a bit. But when he was released in 1964, he wrote his magnum opus, his greatest work. It is called Al-Ma'alim Fi Tariq, and it is translated in English as Milestones. If you search for Milestones of Sayyid Qutb, you will find it even online. This was his political and religious manifesto in which he talked about how Muslims need to address issues. He was finally hanged 2 years after in 1966 because Al-Azhar University as well declared him to be a munharif and a deviant and so on. Now, I want you to observe that the arguments that Sayyid Qutb presented at first are very valid and that no Muslim would disagree with it. You see, when Muslims break into two to say the problem with Muslims is we are not modern, we need to reform and we need to take cues from Western society, and the other group says that no, the problem is we're not loyal to Islam and we need to go back to original Islam, you will find most Muslims gravitating to the second group, to saying we need to go back to original Islam. And that includes the Shia as well. That has more appeal because it takes away that sense of guilt that you are watering down your faith and that you are now turning something sacred to something that can constantly be changed. Which tells you that within the Muslim psyche, the idea of someone changing the Sharia is not agreeable. That the Sharia of Muhammad should remain the same. Now, look at the arguments of Sayyid Qutb. He first argued that, look, Allah, the whole earth belongs to whom? It belongs to Allah. It is His and His alone. Now, he capitalized on a term called Jahiliyyah. Jahiliyyah was first used as to describe anyone opposed to Islam by Ibn Taymiyyah, and then it was used by Abu A'la Maududi, but the one who made it a popular term was Sayyid Qutb. He said anything that opposes God's rule is Jahiliyyah. Now, Jahiliyyah has a repulsive connotation to Muslims because the moment you use the term Jahiliyyah, ignorance, they ascribe it to Ayyam Jahiliyyah, which was at the time before Islam that the Quraysh followed. So he used the term very powerfully, very effectively, and very cleverly. He said, he essentially described a world that was black and white. There was Muslims and there was the West. There was Islam and there was Jahiliyyah. This is all there was. Okay, he said, look, when Allah created the earth, He says very clearly in the Quran, إِنِّي جَاعِلٌ فِي الْأَرْضِ إِنْ خَلِيفَ. I am going to make humans my vicegerent on the earth. So we are meant to be God's representatives on the earth. He then promised humans that His religion will dominate over all the world. هُوَ الَّذِي أَرْسَلَ رَسُولَهُ بِالْهُدَى وَدِينِ الْحَقِّ لِيُظْهِرَهُ عَلَى الدِّينِ كُلِّ. Okay, so up to this point, no Muslims are in disagreement. Allah then said, whoever follows this religion, guidance will come from me. لا خوف عليهم ولا هم يحزنون. You will neither grieve nor will you have any fear. Every time human race went astray in the past and steeped in jahiliyyah, look how he's using the term, Allah would send another prophet to guide them and bring them back to Islam. And those nations who refused to listen to the prophet and clung to jahiliyyah, Allah destroyed them to stop the spread of corruption. And the Quran says, Inna huda Allahi huwa al-huda. The only guidance is the guidance of Allah. And the Quran says, وَمَنْ يَبْتَغِ غَيْرَ الْإِسْلَامِ دِينًا فَلَنْ يُقْبَلَ مِنْهُ. Whoever seeks or desires any religion other than Islam, it will not be accepted from him, and he will be amongst the losers in the hereafter. And the Quran says that human beings were at one point one nation. And as well we know that humans are essentially spiritual beings first and then corporal beings. And that the angels prostrated before Adam because he of his spiritual level and because of what man can achieve. So without spiritual progress and values, the West's progress was nothing but a move towards self-destruction. Then he said to the Muslims, if you are fooled by the Western societies you live in and you think that these are more progressive, then look at the Quran and the stories of the people of Salih and Hud. Look at the people of Ad and Thamud. The Quran in chapter 26, verse 146 to 152 and other verses clearly says that the people of Salih and Hud were living in lavish dwellings and lush gardens. So they were living the most modern societies that you ascribe today to the societies you live in the West. So he says the West today is exactly the same as the Qawm of Ad and Thamud. They were living this lavish lives and, you know, life of decadence where God was out of the picture and you are free to do as you please and it's your right and so on and so forth. He then went on to say, if nothing stood to rise and stop this ignorance, Salawat ala Muhammad. Can I request everyone to move forward, please? There's a lot of people apparently outside trying to come into the mosque and there's no room. If you can please move forward or stand and move forward and recite salawat and please come forward. Jazakumullah khairan jazakumullah. There are still people walking in, so if we can have another salawat ala Muhammad wa ali
Muhammad.
So Sayyid Qutb now argued. He said, look, if no one stands to rise and stop this jahala, then corruption will spread all over the earth. And Allah says this in the Quran, that if people don't stand up for justice and to fight corruption, then corruption will spread on the earth. And Western jahiliyyah was therefore rebellion against the sovereignty of God. At best, it only promotes atheism or agnosticism. Okay, now, the solution to all the problems, Sayyid Qutb argued, was Islam. It was only God's religion that could and must dismantle the West from its position of authority and its dominance in the world as a force that spreads evil and corruption. But now the question was, how do you practically go about doing this? You've come up with a very nice plan that the problem is corruption, and that Islam is meant to save the souls and offer salvation to people. This was God's plan. He created humans for that. But the corruption that is spreading is causing Islam to diminish, and it's going to spread on the earth like wildfire, and therefore this jahala has to be reversed. Now, his solution to this was that there is only two ways to do it. Sorry, there's only one way to do it. And it is at this point that now Sayyid Qutb now goes down a slippery slope, which now leads us to a free fall into the abyss of radicalism. in his book, The Milestones, he says there is a two-pronged approach, preaching and combat. However, preaching will not work for the West. And these are his words. He says, the abolition of man-made laws cannot be achieved only through preaching. Those who have usurped the authority of God and are oppressing God's creatures are not going to give up their power merely through preaching, because he's watching the colonialists as well. He's saying you can go preaching till you go blue in the face. These colonialists are not going to go. The only language they know is force, because they came in with force, they invaded us, they took power by force. We're going to have to use power to fight them back. Then he goes on to say, Islam cannot accept any compromise with Jahiliyyah, either in its concept or its modes of living derived from this concept. Either Islam has to remain or Jahiliyyah has to remain. Islam cannot and accept to a situation where there is half Islam and half Jahiliyyah. These are Sayyid Qutb's words as well. So you can see that what Sayyid Qutb is calling for is this momentous battle between Islam and the rest. Now, where he is naive is the fact that he is not seeing that what he is suggesting is now a perpetual battle between Muslims and non-Muslims. What he is suggesting is jihad at a global scale that will never end. How do you prevent jihad from becoming the status quo for Muslims so that that is their primary mission in life, that we just have to keep fighting and fighting the enemy until we die? You see, what he fails to recognize is that the Prophet ﷺ, whenever he had an option to choose between battle and peace, he always chose peace. Even when the odds were against him, like at Hudaybiyah, where, and that is, in all the battles, Allah does not say this was a great victory for you, Fathum Mubin. But when he signs a treaty that is against the favor of Islam at face value, then Allah says, Inna fatahna laka fatham mubina. We have given you an open and great victory. So he fails to realize this. He also fails to realize that the Prophet ﷺ would send ambassadors to other nations. He wouldn't go and attack and invade and forcefully change them. Even when the Christians of Najran refused to change, they set a pact in where the Muslims would offer them protection and they would pay a tax. But it wasn't, you have to, otherwise we compel you or we kill you. Now, the Prophet had an option to choose between wherever he had an option to choose between war and peace, he chose the latter. However, the early leaders of the Muslims, the caliphs who ruled over Islam, they showed the opposite. They invaded lands and took power. And this is exactly the reality we see with all the groups that commit acts of terror in the name of Islam today. If you read the language of all these terrorist groups who do it in the name of Islam, you will see they talk about how a Muslim has to be perpetually in jihad and that jihad never ends. You live and breathe for jihad. They draw this inspiration directly from books such as Sayyid Qutb's. Now, at what point do we disagree with Sayyid Qutb? We might agree up to this point with Sayyid Qutb that we have a duty and obligation to spread Islam, and we have a duty and obligation to make sure that corruption ends and we fight it. When Sayyid Qutb was asked, is it permissible to kill innocent civilians? His response was as follows. He said, it is preferable not to harm innocent civilians, and that would be the ideal situation if we could avoid it. However, because the Quran says, Al-fitnatu ashaddu min al-qatl, mischief and corruption is worse than killing. If it comes to that, then it comes to that. And it is at this point where now these revivalists who wanted to purify Islam begin losing the majority of the Muslims. Because now the majority of Muslims says, hold on now this is not acceptable. This argument now doesn't hold water. I want to tell you something very interesting. Scholars have said that Ayatollah Khomeini found inspiration in the readings and works of Sayyid Qutb. And Osama bin Laden also found inspiration from Sayyid Qutb. And Ayman Zawahiri also found inspiration from Sayyid Qutb. Now, all these days that I've been talking about Orthodox Islam, I have been saying that the Tashayyu' perspective emphasizes Adala. And in fact, one of the sisters sent me a comment that I think was very nice. She said to me that, look, when you were saying in the early days that the Shias have something that insulates them from being radicalized, it was being misunderstood and offending our Sunni brothers and sisters. She said to me, perhaps instead of saying the Shias, you should say the Shia ideology has something in its principles that insulates from radicalization. And I really like that, and I think that is really a very fair correction. Why? Because having something in your ideology does not mean you practice it. If a Shia doesn't understand his aqidah, he could still commit acts of violence. So if you can keep that in mind, even in the lectures that I've said before, that when I'm saying this idea of adala and imama insulating us from being radicalized, I'm talking of the principles of tashayyu and not necessarily every Shia having it in their blood, because they have to understand their aqidah to practice it. What is the difference between Khomeini and Osama bin Laden if both of them were inspired by Sayyid Qutb? Why is it that Osama bin Laden could justify what he did for 9/11, if we say it was him who did it, but Ayatollah Khomeini could never have justified that and said even killing innocent civilians was justified, right? The reason is because the moment he would do that, from a Shia perspective, he loses legitimacy as a scholar and an individual. Because this idea of adala is stressed in the Shia madhab. In Shia madhab, the caliph cannot be ghair adil. A sahaba is not a sahaba if he is not adil. The leader of the ummah has to be adil. The imam has to be adil. His imama is violated if he is not adil. And this imam being adil, comes right down to the imam of salat. The person leading salat has to be adil. And this is found only in the madhab of tashayyu. And this is the point we're trying to say, that some of these ideas, if they were brought into the ummah, then these would save us from our enemies being able to prey upon those who could be radicalized. If, for example, Sayyid Qutb was talking to a society that strongly believed in this concept of adala that is understood by the Shias from their imams, it would have been impossible for him to convince anyone of this statement, that because the Quran says corruption is worse than killing, therefore we prefer not to kill innocent, but if they have to be killed, then it's okay for the spread of Islam. There's no way he could have justified this. Right? And this is what we're trying to say, that when you insist on adala, then you insist on an adil imam, and that brings in the idea of an imama and the idea of a leadership that is inspired divinely and that comes directly through succession from the Prophet sallallahu alaihi wasallam. Now, let me summarize this lecture and then end it. In a sense, when Muslims divided into modernists and reformists, it was no different from the early days when Muslims divided into the Mu'tazilites and the Ash'arites. The Mu'tazilites came up with the idea that we should give reasoning importance. And they went too far and downplayed the importance of scripture. As a backlash, the Ash'arites came and said, no, scripture is more important. And now they emphasized that we should shun any science that is outside Islam and only emphasize Quran and a literal interpretation of the Quran. Can you see this is exactly what is repeating again and again? And the modernists were saying the same thing. We should look outside and bring things outside Quran. And the fundamentalists were, as a backlash, were saying, we want only Islam and we want only Quran. The Shias, on the other hand, were arguing that al-amru bayn al-amrayn, just like there is no predestination and free will, there is a middle path where the scripture is primary, but it never opposes reason. And reason, correctly placed, will never oppose scripture. You see this in Jamaluddin Afghani, where he's trying to balance Islam with modernity. And then you see this decline with Abdu, where he emphasizes modernity. And then you see the backlash to this with his student Rida, and then Al-Banna and Sayyid Qutb. And so, if you look at Ma'amun, he promoted Mu'tazilites. And then as a backlash, Mutawakkil comes and promotes Ash'ari faith. And as I mentioned, most Muslims would want to be loyal to Islam and Quran. But the problem is that Muslims are swinging like a pendulum from one extreme to the other. There is always this ifrat and tafrit, as opposed to following the middle path. If I have time tomorrow, I will talk about the Arab Spring, and I will give you proof of this again to show you that this is the same path. The Ahlul Bayt always emphasized the middle path, the path of moderation. This middle path of moderation is not the path of sitting on a fence and not taking sides. Rather, it is saying the fences are on the two extremes, but Islam is the path in the middle. Now, I want to end by saying that, unfortunately, amongst the Shias today, we are witnessing the same problem, particularly Muslims and Shias living in the West. All these nights that I have been discussing, I have been critical of Sunni Islam. Why? Because I have been saying that Orthodox Islam is missing some ingredients, and these ingredients are the ingredients of Adala and Imama. And in order to prove this point, I've had to discuss the history of early Islam and question a lot of things in order to bring this perspective that the Ummah that we see as a majority are missing these values. Having said that, when I look at the Shia as well, particularly living in the West, I find that the same tendencies of when we disagree or when we sense our community is in turmoil and it needs reform or revival, we immediately break into two groups again. And again, there is two extremes. Either we become a group that is very liberal-minded and very pluralistic in its ideas, that says we need to imitate the West, we need to shun a lot of things that we do as Muslims, we need to change how we practice our faith and rituals, we need to question some of the laws of Sharia, and we need to distance ourselves from marja'iyat and taqleed. These are old men living in dusty towns and alleyways who have no idea what we have to deal with, and we need to take things in our control. We do not wish to be patronized, and we from here onwards will figure the way ourselves. These are now the modernists, the reformists, the Mu'tazilites, right? The Sarsayyids. Then we have the other side, where you have the Shia saying, hold on, the problem is not this, the problem is we have stopped following the Ahlul Bayt alayhimus salam. So we shun philosophy, we shun irfan, we shun this, we take a very akhbari stand, and we emphasize fada'il, masa'ib, we detach from everyone else, we are the chosen people, everyone else is bad, you know, the Sunnis are bad, don't eat their food, don't marry them, don't attach with them, and we take the other extreme. Now someone might ask this question and say, well, if the Shias have this same problem, then are you missing Adala and Imama as well? The answer to that is no, we're not missing Adala and Imama. But either we have forgotten its importance, or we have failed to see its link in relation to what we have today. So for example, we have failed to see the connection between marja'iyya and taqleed with imama. So now we question it. But if we see that continuity that we have had, an unbroken continuity, which many Muslims do not have, then we begin to value what role it plays and how we have survived despite being a minority because of having these values. It is until we appreciate the values of Adala and Imama and the gold mine we are sitting on that we will understand the manhaj of the Ahlul Bayt alayhimus salam, and we will resolve problems, whether we are Shias or Sunnis, through a path of moderation that is neither this extreme nor that extreme. We will use the Quran and Ahlul Bayt on one hand and our reasoning and intellect on one hand, and we will find a way to modernize and to adopt change and improve ourselves without betraying our loyalty to the Quran and Hadith and the Prophet and the Ahlul Bayt alayhimus salam. But we need to have the right understanding of the importance of these values. So inshallah we will try and highlight these tomorrow night and see the challenges that Muslims face, Shia and Sunni, particularly those living in the West. And then whatever is left over inshallah we will tie as loose ends in our final lecture on Monday, insha'Allah, if you can recite aloud, salawat ala Muhammad wa ala. Sallallahu wa sallam alayka ya Aba Abdullah. Ruhi wa arwahu al-alamin lakal fida. يا ليتنا كنا معكم سيدي فنفوز فوزا عظيما. Tonight is the ninth night of Muharram. the days and nights that we wait for around the year have almost come to an end. Tomorrow night is the night of Ashura. And then the day after we will cry for Hussein, and after that then we will cry for Zainab. So we need to use these nights to appreciate the sacrifices of Imam al-Hussein, of his Ashab Ansar, of his family members. And tonight we want to remember the Shabih of Rasulullah, the son of Hussein that we know of as Ali ibn al-Akbar. Ali ibn al-Akbar was the apple of Hussein's eyes. And we are told in historic accounts that there was no individual in the Banu Hashim who resembled the Prophet like him. He was a splitting image of the Prophet. To that degree that when anyone came to Medina and asked the people of Medina, "What did my Prophet look like?" they used to point to Ali ibn al-Akbar and they used to say, "Look at him and you have seen the Prophet." And I believe it is for this reason that perhaps Allah made him so and had him at Karbala, so that he would also be a hujjah over people. Not only did he look like the Prophet ﷺ, he spoke like him, he behaved like him. And in the words of Imam Hussein, he was like the Prophet khulqan wa khalqan wa mantiqan. Which is also why Imam al-Hussein asked him to give the adhan on the day of Ashura. He was using him as itmamul hujjah. Someone asked Imam Zainul Abidin alayhi salam, he said, "Yabna Rasulullah, out of all the shuhada in Karbala, whose musibah was the most difficult for Aba Abdullah?" And Imam Zainul Abidin, you would have thought he would have said it was the baby Ali ibn al-Asghar. But Imam Zainul Abidin said to his companion, he wept. He said, "Of all the shuhada, the one whose musibah was the most difficult on Hussein's heart was that of Ali ibn al-Akbar." You begin to see how special he was to Hussein. On the way to Karbala, when Imam Hussein had a dream and he heard someone saying, "This qafila is being taken towards martyrdom," and he told this to his son Ali ibn al-Akbar. Ali ibn al-Akbar asked his father, "Awalasna ala al-haq ya abata? Are we not on the right?" And Imam Hussein said, "Bala ya bunayya." And he said, "Then we don't care, la nubali, whether death pounces on us or we pounce on death." You can see how proud Imam al-Hussein was of this son, that his values, his thoughts, his thinking. And all the shuhada came to Imam al-Hussein asking for permission. This was one shaheed that Imam Hussein presented himself and said to him, "Taqaddam ya bunayya." The one that he loved so much, he wanted to present himself. If Zainab gave her Aun and Muhammad, if Kulthum gave Abbas, if Farwa gave Qasim, then Hussein was going to give Ali ibn al-Akbar. And the Arbab of Azar say that once the Ashab and Ansar had become Shaheed, then Imam al-Hussein called his son Ali ibn al-Akbar. And he said to him, "Now it is the turn of the family members to go. Taqaddam ya bunayya." He tied an amama on the head of his son Ali ibn al-Akbar. He kissed his forehead. Then he said to him, "Now go bid farewell to the women and go bid farewell to your aunt Zainab." Some of the Arbab of Aza say his mother Layla was there in Karbala. Some of them say she was not there, but she was raised by his aunt Zainab. In any case, Zainab alayhi salam had this deep-seated love for Ali ibn al-Akbar. We are told in the books of Aza as well that when this qafila was in Kufa and Sham, a lot of people, when they did not recognize Sayyida Zainab, they used to ask, "Who is that lady on whose rida, on whose clothes there is blood? Who is this lady whose clothes has blood?" And this is how they were identifying her. And that blood was the blood of Ali ibn al-Akbar, because she had thrown herself on his body after his martyrdom. So when Zainab alayhi salam had to leave Ali ibn al-Akbar, the books of Maqtal tell us that Ali ibn al-Akbar, when he left the Khayyam, it was like a janazah was leaving. Because every time he tried to leave, someone would pull him back. And the flaps of the tent would rise and they would fall, and they would rise and they would fall. And finally, Hussein alayhi salam brings his son out and says taqaddam ya bunayya, and then we are told thumma nadhara ilayha nadran ayisin, then Hussein looked at his Akbar with despair, like a father who is heartbroken. He said, go my son. Ali ibn al-Akbar goes out for jihad. He comes out into the battlefield. Imam al-Hussein looks up to the heavens and said, Allahumma ashhad ala ha'ula al-qawm. O Allah, bear witness on this people. Faqad baraza ilayhim ghulamun ashbahu an-nas bi nabiyyika khulqan wa khalqan wa mantiqan. O Allah, bear witness, I am now sending one who resembles your prophet in every manner. And every time, my Lord, I have wished to do ziyarah of your prophet, I used to look at this young man. Ali ibn al-Akbar comes into the Maidan. He begins to recite his rajs. He begins to introduce himself and say, Ana Ali ibn al-Husayn ibn Ali. Nahnu wa baytullahi awla bin nabi. Tallahi la yahkumu fi nabnu da'i. أضرب بالسيف أحامي أن عبي ضربا غلام هاشمي علوي. Now Ali ibn al-Akbar challenges them to jihad. One after the other come out and face him. We are told he kills 120 of them. When 120 of them have been sent to Jahannam, Umar ibn Sa'd sends one of his most valiant and one of his most fierce soldiers to Ali ibn al-Akbar. When Hussein sees this giant stand and rise to come fight with him, he begins to think, my son is thirsty for 3 days and nights. He sends a message to Fiddah. He says, O Fiddah, ask the mother of Ali ibn al-Akbar to pray for him. My son is thirsty for 3 days. He now faces a fierce enemy. Whether this mother is Layla or Zainab, I do not know. But she went into prostration and began praying to Allah, Ya man radda Yusuf ila Yaqub. O you who returned Yusuf to Yaqub, Rudda ilayya waladhi, let me see my son once more. Ali ibn al-Akbar, the blood of Hussein rages in his veins. He sends him to the fire of hell as well. He comes back, he says, Baba, did you see my jihad? Marhaba, my son, marhaba. And then he says, Abata, al-atash kad qatalani. Baba, thirst is killing me. وَثِقْلُ الْحَدِيدِ قَدْ أَجْهَدَنِي. Baba, the weight of this sword is now weighing down on me. فَهَلْ شُرْبَتُمْ مِنْ مَا. Baba, is there a sip of water? By Allah, I will go back and do jihad. This breaks the heart of Hussein. Alas, this was one son of Hussein. Hussein had asked him all his life to ask him for something, but he never asked anything from his father. On the day he asked for water, Hussein does not have it to give his son. Hussein gives his ring to Ali ibn al-Akbar. He says, my son, place this on your mouth. Its coolness will give you some help. My Jad Rasulullah will now quench your thirst. Go Ali, go for jihad. Bas Ali ibn al-Akbar gets on his horse once more. Hussein now says wida to his son for the last time. Ali ibn al-Akbar is now going towards jihad. As he goes towards Maidan, he hears someone falling behind him. Then he turns around. He finds Hussein is running behind. He says, Abata, you permitted me to go for jihad. You sent me yourself for jihad. He says, yes, my son Ali. But if only you are sahibe awlad, if only you had a son like you, then you would know what goes through my heart. Go, my son Ali ibn al-Akbar. But oh, my son Ali, as you go for jihad, as you fight, every now and then turn towards the khayam so that I may see you. I wish to still do ziyarah of Rasulullah. Bas Ali ibn al-Akbar goes for jihad. As he continues to fight, a man named Murra bin Munqidh rises. He says, by Allah, may the sins of all the Arabs be on my head if I do not kill this young man. He brings a spear to the battlefield. He looks for an opportunity to strike Ali ibn al-Akbar. As Ali ibn al-Akbar is busy in jihad, he throws his lance towards him. When the lance pierces the heart of Akbar, Ali ibn al-Akbar tries to remove it. As he removes it, it breaks and the blade remains in the heart of Ali ibn al-Akbar. Now the Arbab of Aza say, while Ali ibn al-Akbar is trying to remove the blade, a man comes from behind and strikes him on the head. A fountain of blood erupts from the son of Hussein's head. Ali ibn al-Akbar bends forward and puts his arms around the neck of his horse. His blood begins to flow on the head of the horse. The horse is now blinded with the blood of Ali ibn al-Akbar. He runs into the midst of the enemies. Now the Arbab of Aza say, they surround him from all sides and pull out their swords. فَقَتَوُهُ إِرْبًا إِرْبًا. They begin to slash him with the blades of his swords from all sides. When Ali ibn al-Akbar cannot hold himself on the horse anymore, he calls out, Ya Abata, Alayka minni salam. Baba, this is the last salam from your Ali ibn al-Akbar. The Mu'arrikh says, Hussein goes out to the Maidan. Sometimes he stood and sometimes he stared. I would say, oh Mu'arrikh, you did not understand. Hussein was not sitting and standing. Hussein was running to his Ali. But he kept falling and stumbling on the sands of Karbala, calling out, Wa Aliya! Wa Aliya! Allama Majlisi says, when Hussein came to the body of Ali ibn al-Akbar, he saw three things. The first thing he saw was his son was writhing in pain on the sands of Karbala. The second thing he saw was Ali ibn al-Akbar had his hand on his chest. And the third thing he saw was that Zainab was already there before Hussein. But Hussein sent his sister back to Khayyam. Zainab, go back to the Khayyam. Now Hamid ibn Muslim says, he says, the way Hussein cried at the body of Ali ibn al-Akbar, he cried so loudly the enemies began to weep. The enemies wept when they saw Hussein weeping. For every shaheed, Hussein sat down. He placed the head of the shaheed on his lap. But for Ali ibn al-Akbar, he said, In kabba alayhi. He threw himself on the body of Ali ibn al-Akbar. فَوَضَعَ خَدَّهُ عَلَىٰ خَدِّهِ. Then he placed his cheek on the cheek of Ali ibn al-Akbar. Then he said, بُنَيَّا الدُّنْيَا بَعْدَكَ الْعَفَىٰ. My son, this world has lost all meaning after you. Ajrukum ala Allah. Ajrukum ala Allah. Then Hussein saw Ali ibn al-Akbar's hand on his chest. He said, what do you feel, my son Ali ibn al-Akbar? Ali ibn al-Akbar remembered he asked his Baba for water and his Baba could not give it to him. He did not want his father to have that pain in his heart. He said, Baba, my Jad, your Jad Rasulullah is here. He is holding water for me. Don't worry, I will not be thirsty now. He said, move your hand, my son. When Ali ibn al-Akbar moved his hand, Hussein saw the blood in the heart of Ali ibn al-Akbar. Now the Arbab of Aza say, the arwah of the Anbiya were in Karbala. Adam was in Karbala. Nuh was in Karbala. The ruh of Ibrahim was in Karbala. I would say, oh Nuh, your son was disobedient, but you cried for him. Ibrahim, you put a band on your eyes when you had to slaughter Ismail. Yaqub, you cried for your Yusuf until you went blind. You will not be able to see this. This is now the Bon Adim. Turn your faces away. Hussein put his hand on the blade. Every time he pulled the blade, the body of Akbar lifted with the blade. When he couldn't remove the blade, Gharib Hussein, he put one knee on the hot sands of Karbala. He held the body of Akbar with the other knee. Then he took hold of the blade. Then he turned towards Najaf. Ya Ali! Then he pulled the blade out. With the blade, the ruh of Akbar left his body. Hussein cried, بنيا لقد استرحت من هم الدنيا وغمها. My son, you have now rested from the sorrows of this world. وبقي أبوك وريدا فريدا. You have left your father all alone. Then he turned to the Khayyam. Oh children, come help Hussein. لا طاقة لي على حمله. By Allah, I cannot lift him. Hussein took the body of Akbar back. The women came out. Zainab threw herself on Akbar. Wa Aliya, wa Ghariba, wa Akbara.